Thank you, Bob. That was great. And now for part two of that line of discussion, we have Mark Crispin Miller, who's a professor of media ecology, Department of Cultural and Communication at NYU, and is director of PROMO, Project on Media Ownership. He's the author of a lot of interesting books. One of them is called Boxed In, The Culture of TV, Seeing Through Movies, Mad Scientists, The Secret History of Modern Propaganda, and of Spectacle, Operation Desert Storm and the Triumph of Illusion, an analysis of the media response to that war. He's written a million articles, and he's probably best known most recently for this fantastic chart that he did for The Nation magazine on media ownership. It was very, very widely hailed. It's extremely valuable. And I wish you could all see it from where you're sitting, but you can get it in an old issue of The Nation. So here's Mark Miller. He'll tell you.
This chart actually does not appear in any issue of The Nation. That's okay. An early version of the chart did appear. This is completely up to date. You can find a version of this at our website, whose address is www.mediaownership.org. You're welcome. Our aim is to build a global database of media ownership information for all the culture industries worldwide. And we're presently spending a lot of time humiliating ourselves in the offices of major and minor foundations trying to raise the money to do that. But I think that this would be an indispensable resource for any of us in this room, certainly, because you got to know who pays the piper. Well, I, too, am going to do a kind of good news, bad news thing. And I'll start out with the bad news because there's so much of it. And I would agree with Bob that it's extremely useful to read Milton Friedman in order to get a sense of the program of this global system, the neoliberal system. It's also worthwhile to return to George Orwell's classic 1984, and I'll tell you why. It's very interesting. It's an extremely prescient book. One of the developments that it anticipates so brilliantly is really the world as super saturated by the likes of Rupert Murdoch and others. All of the so-called proles in the world of the novel, that is the 80-85% of the people who make up the population of Oceania, are subjected to a daily diet of sadistic thrillers, idiotic comedies, and pornography, which is all churned out by the Ministry of Truth. Okay? They don't, in other words, they get the New York Post, you know? They watch Fox TV, you know? And it's only the members of the inner party who are coercively and heavily propagandized with overt political propaganda. Although Rupert does his share of that as well. As you know, I'm already getting off the subject. He published Deng Xiaoping, My Father, by Deng's daughter, Deng Mao Mao. The dust jacket says, a bestseller in China, which is really, you know, gee, I wonder why. And it's the kind of thing that you would hear come squawking over the loudspeakers in Beijing. I mean, it's just outright Chinese communist propaganda about her saintly father and his devilish enemies and so on. And Rupert published the book in this country and personally accompanied the author on her author's tour, all because he wants access to the Chinese market for his Asian TV system. It's that simple. You know, so he's not going to play favorites. He may be very right-wing, but the Chinese communists are okay with him. Okay. Let me just talk a little bit about some of the consequences of the oligopolistic system that we have outlined here and about which Bob spoke so lucidly, because the consequences are the very consequences that you all deplore and which you are all so justly and nobly confronting now and combating. It has everything to do. It has everything to do. Don't applaud yourselves. Just applaud me. I only got 20 minutes, all right? Just the media system does indeed have everything to do with this. It's not a side issue. It is not coincidentally the way it is, because of the workings of the World Trade Organization. It's crucial. It's central. Now let's take a look at one of the effects that this kind of ownership has had on journalism. What do they want in the parent companies? What do they want at Disney? What do they want at News Corporation? What do they want at Viacom? They want, first of all, to cut costs. So when they buy a news division, they slash the budgets. They close foreign bureaus, or they've been doing that for some time. Increasingly, CNN is sort of the AP or Reuters for all the other broadcast news divisions in the United States. There really are no foreign bureaus of the other networks. They also, at the same time, want stuff that will appeal immediately. You know, the stuff that's lurid, that's about a celebrity, preferably a dead one, you know. Maybe one who's in trouble with the police. Often a little child shall lead them. You know, JonBenet, Alien Gonzalez, and so on. So they want stuff that is, on the one hand, People magazine type affair, and at the same time, they don't want to spend a lot of money. So for economic reasons alone, they're not going to cover anything that matters. It would require some kind of investigative effort, and they don't have the budget for it. You know, they're not interested. And, as Bob pointed out, they have a profound ideological investment in staying far, far away from issues that might somehow hurt their interests, you see? And since the parent companies have so many interests, you know, since GE, for example, is a major defense contractor and is heavily involved in nuclear power, they're not going to smile on one of their reporters' suggestions that, gee, maybe we should do something on the dangerousness of the nuclear industry in India. Yeah, it's not going to get him anywhere, you see? So you have to understand that this is more often than not a system that is guided not by directives from on high, although they do on occasion come down. They do. Phone calls do come down from the top. But more often than not, journalists inside have simply learned, they've internalized the rules, you know? And they have developed that necessary sixth sense that you need to get ahead in any institution. Yep, university, it doesn't matter what it is. But you just have to learn how to play by the rules. The ones who learn how to do that tend to be the ones who do the best. And the ones who do the best are the ones who tend to buy the whole program. It's a fact, by the way, despite all the propaganda about our liberal media, according to a very important, I'll let the laughter die down, according to a very important poll that was published last year by FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, that in fact, on economic issues, the Washington Press Corps is way to the right of the American people on almost every count, okay? And that is because they have so much money. They're so high paid. They're rich, you know? The anchormen at the networks are all millionaires. I mean, these guys are...
And women,
okay. Diane Sawyer, right? Okay. Well, anyway... What I'm suggesting is that the news, as it was occasionally practiced on TV some 25 years ago, not often, but occasionally, the news as we once knew it is really more and more a thing of the past. As the newscasts become more and more ad-like, they become more and more hospitable to the advertising, because remember, in any commercial system, it is the advertisers only who matter. It is not the audience. Understand that. Okay, so numbers don't necessarily do any good. The numbers of which block, in other words, which numbers are we talking about? Which people are we talking about? And what these particular corporations are most interested in are those who have the most consumer dollars to spend. That's just a fact. So the advertisers are in fact all important. Now let me quickly take you through. This is just for the sake of intellectual convenience. Most of you know all this already. I'm just trying to put it into kind of a comprehensible order for you. The different categories of consequence, ill effects, of a commercial system, a commercial media system, that is operating not only in the United States, but more and more the world over. Baywatch is not just the most popular show in the United States. It's the most popular show in the world, Baywatch is. We're talking about a kind of spectacle that has vast appeal and which provides opponents of publicly supported systems with a powerful, albeit facile, argument in favor of privatization. I want to make a suggestion to you, and that is that wherever the commercial media succeeds in dominating the cultural atmosphere, the commercialism has demonstrable destructive effects. The system, as a global system, is finally ecologically and psychologically insupportable. Cannot go on. Okay? Now, first of all, just to speak most obviously, the wares that the system sells are unhealthy wares. The product that most of the ads hawk is often unhealthy, you know, detrimental to the well-being of mind and body. Once the tobacco companies were forced to retrench somewhat in this country, and as smoking ceased to become a widespread habit and became more and more a habit of the lower stratum of the population, which is what has happened. You know, blue-collar workers, blacks, Hispanics, kids, and working women are the nation's smokers now. People in the upper stratum have quit. As that has happened, the tobacco companies have moved abroad. Many of you know this. They're in the third world aggressively marketing Marlboros in Nicaragua and Vietnam and Russia and so on. Liquor, right? The legal drug. The drug that it's okay to sell. The drug that has not been outlawed, although it is the most violent drug there is. Right? The drug that really leads to the most crime, while on the other hand, the illegal drugs are the ones that have America's prison gulag packed with 2 million people, right? And millions more awaiting sentencing. Something we don't often hear about on the news. Anyway, liquor is freely advertised and more the world over, and it is striking that one of the big media giants Bob mentioned is Seagram, which is, of course, a major distiller. Fatty food. Now, here I want to make a suggestion to you, and that is that the problems that we worry about cropping up abroad are problems that have been in place in the United States for a long time. There are fast food outlets disproportionately placed throughout the inner cities. One of the reasons why in black neighborhoods there's such an astronomical level of heart disease and hypertension has something to do with the diet there. And that has to do with McDonald's and Burger King and KFC and all the rest of them, which advertise heavily on TV, right? Refined sugar, we can go through the list of destructive products that people use very, very heavily, and the more often in those places where long-standing rituals of dining and so on and family structures have given way to something like the highway-based, advertising-based system of the United States. Now, to move outside the body, the second category, after the products that the system sells, there are the byproducts of that sale. And here I'm talking about the ecological consequences of a commercial system such as the one that we're all confronting. Do I have to name them? Global warming, and we know how complicit in the rise of global warming the IMF and World Bank have been. The destruction of the wetlands, the destruction of the ozone layer, the runoff of chemical fertilizers into the groundwater and so on. In every instance, these kinds of catastrophic developments have everything to do with the transformation of the world into a gigantic breeding ground for animals that can be fed and slaughtered to make whoppers. I'm overstating somewhat, but you take my point. I think I'm among friends. You never know, but I think I'm among friends. Now, most subtly and most controversially, there are the more intangible consequences. You might call them the spiritual consequences of the pitch, the sales pitch, which is advertising. And understand what advertising is. Advertising is not just a celebration of the commodity as that which will cure all ills and solve all problems. It isn't only that. It is a propaganda on behalf of a certain world order. It is a celebration of a certain lifestyle. It is a celebration of a certain grotesque caricature of individualism. That is, you come first. You're more important than anyone else. It is a constant temptation to enjoy a great vicarious experience of empowerment. But that empowerment is understood in very limited terms. It has no political meaning. Power, as advertising represents it, means being drop-dead gorgeous, cool as ice, indifferent to others' sufferings, perfectly self-interested, always good-looking, always, strangely enough, fit and gorgeous despite all the crap you're eating and drinking. You know. Now, critics of advertising are often accused, I've often been accused, of elitism. I love that one, elitism. Because the idea is, well, you think the masses are too stupid, you know, etc. Everybody's persuaded by propaganda if it's intelligently done. Everybody, not just the masses, but also the classes. Everybody buys it. In fact, the higher up the social ladder you go, certain propagandas are more effective with people. People down toward the bottom tend to be smarter about certain kinds of propaganda, right? So there's no elitism at work here. That's itself an elitist lie. The stuff works. If it didn't work, they wouldn't be spending all this money on it, right? They wouldn't be spending all this money on the ads, and they wouldn't be doing all this to make advertising inescapable. It works. And we can see that it works, for example, in the rising rates of eating disorders among very, very young children all over the world. This has been going on since the 80s, in this country and abroad, even in the Fiji Islands, eating disorders. And it has a lot to do with the constant fantasy of, you know, Stephanie Seymour, or whoever it is, Xena, the warrior princess. I mean, that body, that look is inescapable. Young girls see that, and they take that in, and it has had much to do with the rise of bulimia and anorexia and disorders like that. And then there's violence, okay? There's violence, which is indeed a kind of national and I would say more and more international epidemic. And I am not making the simplistic argument that if a bunch of people see a murder committed on the screen, they will run out and do likewise. Sometimes that actually does happen. There are instances of such crude copycat criminality. But I would make a subtler argument. I would say that no matter what you watch, if you have that TV set on for hours a day, and you get that message day after day, week after week, it isn't only that you're going to see a lot of sadistic behavior portrayed in a cavalier, even in an ironic way. It isn't just that. It's that you are constantly being told that you are the center of the universe, you come first, and life ought to be lived as if you were the perfect car speeding down an endless highway, no impediments, no stoplights, no baggage, no other passengers. It's just you, baby. You know, you are your Toyota, right? You don't have to stop. Anyone who tries to stop you should be waxed, should be killed immediately. Run them down, kill them, fuck them, right? That's that. So in the real world, where things are increasingly complicated, where there are long lines, you know, where you have to wait for your flight, or you can't get a job, or you don't know how to get to work. It seems to me that that's a kind of recipe for explosive rage, because you're constantly being promised you can sail above it all, thanks to Cisco Systems, whatever the hell it is, right? But meanwhile, back down here on Earth, that isn't the way it is, okay? So I would say that the relationship between media and violence, which has been amply documented by social scientists, has to be understood still more subtly. All right, now, that's all the bad news. Okay, I'm wrapping up. 2 minutes, okay. 2 minutes. The good news, all right? The project on media... Hey, you rang the bell, all right? The Project on Media Ownership did two polls, one in December of 98 and one in March of 99. And we were actually trying to find out what people know about the giveaway of the digital TV spectrum, which many of you may know about, part of the 96 telecom bill. What do people know about it, and what do they think about it once they find out? Okay? These were not progressives whom we polled, believe me. These were just middle-class, lower-middle-class people, cops, right? Seriously. Well, they're people too, you know. First of all, none of them knew about it, right? And how could they, since no one reported on it, okay? But the fascinating and encouraging thing is that once we told them how few companies there are, how they pay nothing to get access to the airwaves, how the airwaves are public property, and how they are worth, by conservative estimates, $70 billion. Let me just tell you that by startlingly high margins, these people were pissed. And they strongly supported radical reforms like bans on advertising to children, corporations... They did, by like 68%. Giving hours of time back to communities for non-commercial local programming, doing educational programs for adults and children, and also having to pay to use the airwaves, right? These are people you wouldn't ordinarily regard as allies in a struggle like this, but the point that I'm making, and I think Bob was making, is that they really could be. They could be allies if there were some way to reach them. That's the hard part. But another interesting thing, and Bob will bear me out on this as well, a lot of people who work inside the media are really sympathetic to this critique. You know, people at the TV stations, TV networks, book publishing companies, music labels, more and more they can see that the kind of work they have to do is embarrassing, it's dreadful, it's false. I'm about to finish. They too can be allies. So despite the bleakness of the picture that I've just painted, I think that you're on the right track. God bless you all.
Okay, now we're going to move on to the other side of this equation that I mentioned earlier. By the way, Randall Forsberg is here. She's hiding over on the side over there because she has a bad back, just so everybody knows. I'm going to introduce next Stephen Staples. He's the chair of the International Network on Disarmament and Globalization, a network of activists and researchers in more than 20 countries concerned about the new global economy and the need for peace, disarmament, and the funding of human needs. The network was established at the Hague Appeal for Peace in 1999. He's also an organizer in British Columbia for the Council of Canadians and works closely with Maud Barlow. A big Canadian contingency here, but he's not going to sing, I don't think, from the Vancouver. He's a frequent lecturer in the U.S., Canada, and Europe. He's produced video documentaries and publishes journals, and he's a an expert on the issues related to the way the military views globalization and what it is trying to do about it. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry. It's wonderful to be in such a beautiful venue like this. We don't get to do speeches like this in churches. I was once an altar boy many years ago, and this is not like my recollection of church when I was 12 years old. I think if it was, I probably would have stuck it out a little bit longer. I want to begin today by doing something that I don't think I've ever done before, which is agreeing with something that the Secretary, U.S. Secretary of Defense William Cohen said recently. He traveled in early 1999. He went from this Washington to the other Washington on the other end of the continent, and Redmond, Washington, specifically, to meet with 200 workers of Microsoft, the Microsurf people that generate all this wonderful software that we use. And he went there with a specific message that he wanted to deliver to those high-tech workers. He said that for all the domestic prosperity produced by the information age, symbolized by the astounding success of Microsoft, U.S. economic power is still dependent on its military strength. U.S. economic power is still dependent on its military strength. And I think that statement is true. And I had to talk about that, and I think that maybe by the time we end this panel, you'll agree with Secretary of Defense William Cohen as well, that U.S. economic power is dependent on its military strength. Today, the U.S. economic power system is based upon globalization, as many people have spoken about today, which has essentially been made possible in addition to the spread of information technology, but the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War, which opened up huge markets around the world for American manufacturers and was able to finally gobble up and integrate those new markets in Eastern Europe and other places that it couldn't get access to before. Globalization is incredibly successful at generating piles of cash. Incredible wealth is being generated by the economic system now. It's being not distributed equitably. It's being concentrated at the top. But since the end of the Cold War, it has not resulted in a peace. And in fact, many countries never even noticed that the Cold War ended because they're still fighting wars that date back to the 70s and 1980s and sometimes even longer than that in the case of Sudan, for example. In fact, today there are 36 wars raging around the world as we gather here for this forum today. What's different is all of these wars are civil wars. They're not between countries, they're within countries. And tragically, most of the casualties from these wars are civilian. In the year 1900, civilian casualties in war amounted to less than 10%. But in the year 2000, civilian casualties accounted for more than 90% of the wars. So it's not the soldiers that are paying the price for the conflict. It's the people, largely women and children, which are dying. But what are the causes of these wars? How can we figure out how to prevent these wars and look at the root causes? Well, essentially, it can be summed up as a loss of human security. And human security is a term that's used quite often in Canada and I think is being used more frequently here in the U.S. as well. But it speaks to the satisfaction of the essential human needs of people in a country. The loss of human security involves the collapse of the state, which is no longer able to meet the needs of its people. It's growing economic inequality, a competition for resources, and environmental degradation. All of these sound familiar to us. The results of economic globalization in many respects. In fact, the United Nations Human Development Report for 1999 identified globalization as causing new threats to human security and as promoting the conditions for war. So here I think we have to ask ourselves, what are the values of the new economy? The proponents of globalization would have us believe that the WTO and these agreements are about regulating international trade, when that's not entirely true, as you would expect from what they say. But globalization is actually about regulating governments. It's about building fences around governments and preventing them from taking on those policies and programs which are essential for providing human security. We can discern more of the values of the global economy for example, just by looking at the decisions from trade rulings within the World Trade Organization. Consistently, ruling after ruling, governments are prevented from promoting public services, from protecting culture, promoting environmental regulations, and doing economic development programs that are designed to shape the economy to provide benefits for everyone based on some sort of democratic decision-making which says this is what we want our economy to do for us. That's what economies are for. But the WTO and globalization is viewing the role of governments in a very limited, very classic way. Essentially, governments, the only thing that's going to be left for them if this current agenda continues is providing for internal order within the state or external defense. So police and military will be left to the government, and that is all. And, of course, taxation in order to pay for all of those. So while public services and environmental regulations are constantly under attack by the WTO and globalization, one holy grail within the economy remains, and that is the military-industrial complex. How is the military-industrial complex protected within globalization? Well, within every trade agreement, as Jerry mentioned earlier, there is a special clause, and you find it consistently in all of them. It gives special protection to military spending in the arms industry. It's called a national security exception. And I'll use an example. GATT Article 21, General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, says that a country cannot be prevented from taking any action it considers necessary to protect its essential security interests relating to the traffic in arms, ammunition, the implements of war, and such traffic in other goods and materials as is carried on directly for the purpose of supplying a military establishment or taken in time of war or other emergency in international relations. Okay? That's basically it. It's very short, but it's very powerful. It is the most powerful clause in the entire agreement because it allows governments to interpret what their own essential security interests are. In fact, other member governments of the WTO can't even challenge it. You can't even pull together a dispute panel on it. There are other weaker exemptions within some of these agreements, but they all have to stand up to a test that they're not impinging on trade, whereas a security exemption is not required. That is why it's the strongest exemption in the GATT. We find it in NAFTA. Article 2102 is a security exemption. The General Agreement on Tariffs or Trade and Services, the GATT's part of the built-in WTO agenda, also has a security exemption in Article 14. And the Agreement on Government Procurement, Article 23, and on and on and on, as you get the idea. So who benefits? Who benefits from having a security exception built into these trade agreements? Well, it won't be surprising to know that the rules of the global economy are essentially written by the industrialized countries, the United States, Canada, Japan, and the members of the European Union, or the Quad, as they're called. The Quad forms the executive, the unofficial executive of the World Trade Organization. Well, of the global military spending, $800 billion, the Quad represents, not surprisingly, the vast majority of military spending is spent by these countries. More than 60%, or about $500 billion a year, is spent on the military. This is money carved out of the liberalizing demands of the global economy. So what happens is the national security exemption promotes military economies over civilian economies. It rewards military spending. It gives advantage to those countries that have huge military budgets, and it begins to militarize public policy even, as in other areas such as research and development, funding of universities, jobs, economic development. You lose those tools, you start doing it through your military spending, further entrenching the military-industrial complex. Here's an example with the World Trade Organization. Okay, it's the Bombardier case. And the Bombardier case revolves around Canadian government subsidies for civilian aircraft production. Bombardier is a Canadian company that makes regional passenger jets. It's actually the third largest builder of civilian aircraft in the world, right after Boeing and Airbus. It doesn't really make military aircraft, though. It does do a lot as far as providing military services and provides military variations of it, but it's largely focused in civilian planes, which is quite different from, for example, Boeing. Now, Brazil launched a challenge against some government programs that were providing funding to Bombardier to build these regional jets. The challenge was brought before the World Trade Organization, and the World Trade Organization ruled that the subsidies provided in this industrial program by the Canadian government were not allowed and struck it down. The Canadian government had to go back and rework the program so that it would fit the World Trade Organization. But in the meanwhile, within a couple of months after the decision came down, the Canadian government announces a brand new $30 million fund, which would be for military production only. And of course, Bombardier is also one of the largest recipients of Canadian military spending, so this money was essentially moved into military spending so that it could subsidize the same corporations that are building, that are still building the same materials. And we were shocked this year to see in this year's federal budget that the Liberal government, our government, is now clawing back the peace dividend that we've been benefiting from since the end of the Cold War. They've increased military spending by $2 billion. I know it's not much in American terms, but we only spend about $10 billion in Canada, but $2 billion over the next 4 years. So clearly, this is driving the agenda. The security exemption within these trade agreements is driving more money, greater importance into military spending. But the security exemption, as I mentioned, allows wealthy countries who have large military budgets to cheat. They can cheat the WTO because the smaller countries can't afford, they don't have enough excess production to drive their economy through military spending. The United States, as I mentioned, is the number one military spender in the world at $276 billion. More than $50 billion of that is directed specifically for weapons procurement. Nobody, no government is going to challenge that kind of raw power, that kind of high technology. And it's only through the billions of dollars of military spending that can provide this kind of protection for corporate interests around the world. And that's Boeing's business. So I think what we have to ask ourselves is this fundamental question. Have we learned nothing from the horrors of the last century? Have we learned nothing from the Hiroshimas, from the Rwandas? Here we stand at the beginning of a new century, but under this current system, this global financial agenda of globalization, we are destined to repeat the mistakes of the last. What we require is fundamental change in our thinking to understand that security does not come from a barrel of a gun. Security does not come from weapons and nuclear weapons and warships and submarines. Security comes from human rights, it comes from a clean environment, it comes from social justice, and it comes from an equitable distribution of wealth. That is where security comes from. I don't think this system is sustainable, because the system that we're working on now, this one, this economic system, is built on an ethic of death. That is the system. In fact, we should call it, you know, it's the Trojan horse economic system, because it's fundamentally unsustainable. You can't build a sustainable global economy that's based on killing and power. It has to be built on life. That's what the economy has to do. So coming down here from Vancouver yesterday to protest the World Bank and the IMF, which I'm really looking forward to, I'm reminded of a friend of mine that I met a few years ago. His name was Jean, and Jean survived Rwanda. He came to Canada as a refugee. He had lost his entire family in Rwanda. There was only him and a few of his brothers and sisters who managed to escape, who were living in Europe. And Jean joined our peace group. I was on the board of this peace group. And he came there to work for peace. I mean, here was a guy who had every right to be angry, to want revenge, to take up arms, but that wasn't his reaction. He joined our peace group because I think more than anyone else, he understood war, the effects of war, and he understood the causes of war. And I won't forget, he had this tattered briefcase he would cart around with him, and he had this big sticker stuck on it. And the sticker said, "A hungry man is an angry man." And that's what it's all about. And that's the message that we'll be taking to the World Trade Organization and the IMF and the World Bank this Sunday. And when I march on the streets on Sunday, I'll be thinking of Jean, and I'll be demanding that globalization stop taking food from people's mouths and putting guns in their hands. So I'll be on the streets on Sunday, and I'll see you there too. Thank you.